Others were born in Lebensborn production homes, Hitler's baby factories, where racially good mothers anonymously gave birth to illegitimate children of SS men.
But those homes were only in Germany.
No, mademoiselle. There was quite an active one here in France. We've heard of them in Denmark, Belgium, and Holland as well. Several in Norway. Those babies are now pariahs. And who knows how many of these little blonde ones were kidnapped from their mother's arms. Hundreds of thousands from Poland alone, meant to be raised as German. There is no record of their parents.
I will check the list myself, madame, if it would spare you the trouble.
Madame Bertillon stopped short and turned to me. You are used to getting your way, I can see. She picked up the tin bowls and thrust them into my hands, the pile tall and cold against my chest, reaching almost to my chin. If you distribute these, only one to a child, and they will try to get two out of you, I will look through my list, mademoiselle. I will fetch you if I find a match. I am not doing this to help you because you came from the consulate, but because I have been on my feet since 5 this morning.
Thank you, madame. Where do I distribute the bowls?
Out there, of course, she said, holding an open palm toward a pair of doors.
What do I do with the extra bowls?
Surely there were too many. There will be no extras, madame said, and bent her head to the list.
I pushed through the doors to a vast hall wainscoted in oak, probably once used for dancing and parties. The ceiling rose up 100 feet, trompe-l'oeil painted to give the impression of radiant summer sky, a nice substitute for the actual heavens that day. There must have been 50 refectory tables there, at which girls sat grouped by age from toddlers to teens. They sat still on their benches, hands in their laps, each quiet as a picture. Behind them, 6 white-frocked women stood beside steaming vats of soup, ready to serve once my bowls were distributed. As I approached, all eyes were on my bowls and me. I stood for a moment, overwhelmed, and then recovered. These children were hungry. I placed a bowl before the first child at the table.
"Merci, madame,"
a child said. I placed a bowl before the next child.
Merci, madame.
I checked the faces for any trace of Rena or Paul, but my task was soon overwhelming. Who knew if the child favored her parents? Was she even still alive? I became skilled at handing out bowls and worked my way to the teens. At the beginning of the row, a girl of no more than 13 sat with a toddler on her lap. The child was dressed in a periwinkle blue velvet shirt, its mother-of-pearl buttons still holding fast. Mother's handiwork. She would be happy.
You are taking good care of her, I said to the girl. No need for 2 bowls, mademoiselle. We share.
The toddler on her lap watched me go by as a stargazer watches a shooting star, and I continued down the row with my bowls. Before long, Madame hurried down one row toward me.
You are in luck, mademoiselle.
She paused to catch her breath, one hand to her lace collar.
We have a few children with that drop-off date. 1 girl that age.
I followed Madame down one row and up the next to a table of 4-year-olds eating their soup. The only sound the scrape of their spoons against tin. The noise in the room magnified as I followed Madame. Colors sharpened. Would this be Paul's child? Finding her would mean extreme happiness for her parents, but the opposite for me.
A child born on April 1st, 1941, would be in our 4-year-old group here,
Madame said, as she checked the child's tag and presented her with a flourish.
Now we have Bernadette.
She was a tow-headed sparrow of a child, her skin almost translucent.
She glanced up at me with a wary look.
"I don't know," I said. "It's hard to say, but I don't think so."
"That is the best I can do," Madame said. "I will keep an eye out for that birth date. Have the parents come in when they are well?"
I lingered in the great hall that day and helped serve the rest of lunch. Madame and I ladled fragrant onion soup, thick with carrots and turnips, into the children's bowls, and handed each child a small piece of bread. Their only words, "Merci, Madame," were tremendous thanks. A plane flew overhead, and some hid under the tables thinking they were still at risk. Many were shod with wooden blocks tied on with rope. I made a note to send shoes and money. I did my best to peer into the face of every child of about the right age, looking for any familiar sign. As Madame and I finished collecting the empty bowls on a tray, a teenager handed me hers. The child at her hip stopped me short.
"Madame, could you come?" I asked.
I set the tray down on the table.
"Would you please look up the number of this child?"
Madame noted the child's number and went for her clipboard.
I couldn't tear my gaze away from the child. She was dark-haired and had almond-shaped eyes like Paul's, and also his coral lips. But everything else about her was Rena. The copper skin, the curve of her nose, down to the ears peeking out from her hair.
"This child has no drop-off date," Madame said. "I am very sorry."
"This is the child, Madame. I'm certain of it." "Her name is Pascaline," the teen said. Madame Bertillon forced in a quick lungful of air. "What is it?" I asked.
"I hate to admit it, but your intuition may be right, Miss Faraday," Madame said, almost smiling.
"How so?"
I asked. The room closed in on us.
"The child's name is Pascaline," Madame said, as if I had missed something obvious.
"So what, for heaven's sake?"
"Every good French Catholic knows the name Pascaline means born on Easter."
Chapter 31, Kasha, 1945. The summer, the year that Susanna and I came home to Lublin, I tried to stay optimistic, but it was hard. Once I learned what had happened during our almost 4 years at Ravensbrück, I couldn't understand why the world had never come to our aid. First with Hitler's invasion in 1939 from the west, then with the Soviet invasion the same month from the east. Though these invasions had caused Britain and France to declare war on Germany, not one Allied soldier had been sent to help us fight. Our first reports of Auschwitz, sent to the Western world by our Polish underground at great risk, had received no response either. Our reports of thousands of our Polish officers murdered in the forest near Katyn, Pietrik's father possibly among them, were ignored by the world as well. So when this world rejoiced at Japan's surrender and the war was officially over, I did not rejoice. The war continued for us, just under a new dictator, Stalin. Though it was not fully apparent right away, Stalin's hand was already over us. Many of the leaders of the Polish resistance, several of them Pietrik's friends, were taken and eventually murdered by the Red Army and the NKVD, Stalin's brutal law enforcement agency. The NKVD were the nice people in charge of ferreting out enemies of the people. They executed tens of thousands of Polish political prisoners and sent thousands more to the gulags. Instead of a fresh start, Poland got new forms of injustice. As a result, we were careful about where we went and spent much time looking over our shoulders. One of the first things I did once I came home was check the secret hiding place Nadia and I had used to exchange books before the war. This was simply a place where teenaged girls had played detective once upon a time. I walked over to Nadia's old street, and the stone wall was still there, crumbling near the edges, but still strong. Would the book Nadia left for me still be there? I slid the stone from the spot in the wall, pulled out the book, and brushed the dust from the yellow cover. It was Kornel Makushinsky's Satan from the Seventh Grade, our favorite book we'd exchanged so many times. How had Nadia been able to leave it after she'd gone into hiding? I looked carefully about to make sure no one was spying on me, sat with my back to the wall, and held the book. The musty scent of the cover brought back earlier days when life had been simpler, when the worst thing we had to worry about was a bad exam grade or an aching tooth. The book opened naturally to chapter 5, and Nadia's gift to me sat there. All 10 of Pietrik's dance tickets she'd bought for me. I was too angry to cry at the wall that day, for the childhood we'd lost came rushing back. We had only wanted to chat with boys and dance and read mysteries. Now Nadia was gone, maybe forever. All I had left of her was a book and a photo buried in the back garden. It was late afternoon by the time I made it home, and I brought up the idea of retrieving the photo of Nadia and the other treasures we buried at the start of the war. "Maybe we should do this another time," Zuzanna said. This was not like my sister at all, to be standing there in the backyard wringing her hands. "Maybe once we're more acclimated, it would be better. This can take an emotional..." "Don't be so nervous," I said. "Why leave the only valuables we have in the ground?" Papa and I shooed away her protests as he paced off the steps. 10, 11, 12. Had the tin cans kept our most precious things safe? Papa stood there for what seemed like a full minute, arms at his sides, the shovel loose in his hand. Was he crying? He then came alive, struck his shovel into the hard-packed earth, and dug like a man whose life depended on what was buried below. He didn't have to dig long before we heard the shovel blade hit tin. All three of us scooped dirt out of the hole with our hands and helped Papa pull out the cans we'd buried so long ago. We sat, out of breath for a while, staring at the cans. Zuzanna cried just looking into that hole. "Missing Matka?" Part of me was happy to see her cry, since she seldom showed her grief. Next, Papa lifted out the tin box with a hinged lid. He opened the top, and it let out a little sigh as air was released. He closed it right away, but not before I saw his old silver revolver there. How many guns did we own now? The millet was next, still surprisingly dry, and maybe even edible, and then we started opening the tin cans. Papa handed one to me, and I scraped away the wax. I pulled the scarf from the can, and it unwound. The scent of Pietrik still there. I opened the next can to find the picture of Nadia and me on the cow. Even my Girl Guide uniform was in perfect shape, and the corduroy dress that Matka had sewn for my 16-year-old body was still bright red. I pulled it on over my skirt and blouse, and it was even loose on me, since I'd still not gained back much weight. None of this caused me many tears, for I was happy to have my precious things back. The last can I opened was a biscuit tin. I broke the wax seal and lifted off the lid. I pulled out Matka's sable brushes, like new inside their flannel wrap, and a surge of sadness rose up and crashed over me there in the yard. Matka was gone, and she would not be coming back to use her brushes. It was my fault, too. I deserved to die for killing my mother. Papa and Susanna surrounded me with their arms as we crouched there by the hole, all crying by then. Through it all, I kept up hope that Nadia and Pietrik would come back and check the list of returning deportees each morning on the corkboard of the Red Cross Repatriation Center at Lublin Hospital. One especially fine late summer morning, I stopped there first thing to check. The staffers were polite, but I could tell they were tired of seeing me limp in every day. The pain in my legs slowed me up and gave them plenty of time to avoid me. When they saw me approach, they made themselves scarce or busied themselves with shuffling papers. If I did get a response from someone, it was curt.
"No, no, Pietrik Makovsky, no Vadia Vatroba either,"
the girl at the desk called out that morning before I said a word. Next, I walked to the postal center to check the list Papa tacked up in the cool front lobby. By summer's end, the thick lists posted on the corkboard there had dwindled to one sad page. I ran my finger down the list, first by the W's and then the B's. Badovsky, Baginski, Bajorek, Bakalar, Bal, Balzer. It felt good to read the names of those lucky few that returned. And I was often at the bottom of the list before I realized the name Pietrik Bakovsky was not included there. Papa came from his office, saw me at the list, and waved me to him.
"Kasha, my love, could you come see me in my office for a moment?"
Why was he being so formal all of a sudden? I walked to his office, the same one he'd had for as long as I could remember, with its high tin ceiling and his wide oak desk covered with packages of every sort, all soon to be expertly delivered by Papa or one of his staff. Something seemed to be missing, and it took me a few seconds to realize what it was. "Where is the flag, Papa?" The Polish flag was one of the first things Papa had put back up in his office once the Nazis left Lublin, much to the happiness of the postal center patrons. Had the new authorities pressured him to remove the flag? He was cooperating with them, it was clear. Papa stepped to the window and pulled down the shade. "We don't have much time, but I had to tell you I've heard something. Don't be alarmed. This is something we can fix." I don't know about you, but when someone says, "Don't be alarmed," I have trouble listening to the rest of what they say, since fear starts running up and down my body.
"What are you talking about, Papa?"
I hadn't seen him so frightened since the night we buried our treasures in the backyard with Matka. Matka. Every thought of her was still a fresh stab.
"I heard that there are rumors going around about you girls who came back from Ravensbrück."
"From who?"
"This is serious, Kasha. They are saying that you are not to be trusted."
"Don't believe all...
Susanna, too."
This sent a real quake of fear through me. "Who is saying this?"
"The authorities."
"Who?
NKVD? Let me talk to them."
"This isn't something to take lightly, Kasha."
"Not to be trusted? What does that even mean?" "They think because you were at Ravensbrück, a German camp, that you were working for the Germans, contaminated by fascism."
"That's ridiculous.
And you've been seen partaking in suspicious activity. Do you have a secret hiding place?"
"The wall by Nadia's house?
That's child's play, Papa. Well, stop it. You are being watched."
"Who can live in such a...
Do you want to go away again? This time for good? Get Susanna and destroy any evidence you were there."
"You're serious.
Your Girl Guide uniform, your letters I saved."
"But if they read the letters, they'd see..."
"They are not easily reasoned with, Kasha. Go. Now."
Susanna and I made a fire in the backyard that afternoon, as one often did to dispose of household trash, and burned the few things we had from the camp. We threw the bags we'd made from our old uniforms on the pyre,
Regina's English book. My Girl Guide uniform. I hesitated when it came to the urine letters I'd sent. Papa had kept them in the kitchen drawer, a neat stack that told the world of our troubles. I can't burn these, I said, my grip on the envelopes tightening. You listed every girl's name in those, Susanna said. You have to protect them. Who cares about some old letters? I still hesitated. Susanna snatched the top letter and handed it to me. Here, she said, and tossed the rest on the fire. At least I would save one. As the fire burned, black bits of ash floated about, much as they had from the Ravensbrück chimneys. When we were done, almost all evidence of our camp life was gone. Who needed such things anyway, we told ourselves. Souvenirs of a terrible time. But it made the black spot in my chest grow larger. I was a patriot. I took an oath to serve my country. I gave up my youth, my mother, my first love, and my best friend for Poland. For this I was accused of being an enemy spy? I tried to focus on good things. Even with a terrible shortage of food and the confusion of people returning to Lublin, there was a ray of optimism surrounding the reopening of demolished factories. The universities were not up and running again, but the Red Cross taught basic nursing classes at the hospital. I headed there one late summer morning, hoping to get some nursing practice. I stepped into the back wing of the hospital, happy to see it had survived the bombings somewhat intact. The massive ward on the second floor was filled with rows of canvas cots divided almost equally, half occupied by Russian soldiers, the other half by Polish civilians from the camps and other places. Russian nurses and medics brought the wounded, presenting with every type of injury imaginable, in on canvas stretchers. We're off to Warsaw soon, said Karolina Uznetsky, one of my favorite nurses, as she unfolded the cot. The army is taking over the hospital. She filled a basin with warm water. I'll miss you all, I said, instead of what I really wanted to say. Please stay. You leave, and who will be here when Pietri comes back? Leaving means you've given up on survivors. How about a free class on the bed-bath? Karolina said. Yes, please, I said. Such an opportunity. The bed-bath was known to be more complicated than it sounded. Let us start over here, Karolina said. She carried a basin of water and a stack of towels straight toward a particularly damaged row of soldiers. The facial injuries were the hardest to deal with. They'd taken the mirrors in the lavatories down for a reason. I forced myself to look. How could I be a nurse if I couldn't deal with such things? Suddenly, I could not recall even basic Red Cross training. Karolina stood at the cot of one of the worst, a dark-haired man who slept curled on his side. The blood that had seeped through the gauze wrapped around his head had dried black. First, introduce yourself to the patient, Karolina said, indicating the man on the cot. We can skip this step, for the patient is unresponsive. It would not be exaggeration to say I idolized Karolina. She was everything a good nurse should be. Smart. Level-headed in the face of gruesome injury. Pleasant. I would have to work on all these things. Ordinarily, we would pull the curtain for patient privacy, Karolina said. But we will go right to the washcloths and rubber gloves. I pushed my hands into the gloves, smooth and powdery inside. The smell of the rubber somehow hopeful. Karolina folded the washcloth over my gloved hand like a mitt. Begin the bath with the face. No soap used there. Eyes first. I sat on a chair next to the patient and started with the eyes, reaching the cloth into the deep sockets and moving outward. Could he even feel it? The soldier next to him lay on his back, arms splayed, snoring louder than any person I'd heard snore before, and there had been many candidates at Ravensbrück. Try to use a different part of the washcloth for every stroke, Carolina said. You are a natural, Kasia.
Her words made me puff up with pride. My mother had been a nurse, after all. Maybe it was in the blood.
There was something satisfying about washing their survivors, revealing clean swaths of pink skin under all that grime, the dirt drifting to the bottom of the bowl. When I finished, the water in the bowl was dark brown, so I replaced it with clean water at the tap. When I returned, medics came with two more Russian soldiers and placed them near us, one with a skull fracture, the other unresponsive. I started a fresh bed bath on one. These men had not washed in months. I knew how that felt.
You're good at this, Kasia, Carolina said. You really should think about coming with us to Warsaw. We could use the help.
I wiped the washcloth down the soldier's forehead and across one cheek. Why not go to Warsaw? Papa might miss me, but his lady love, Marta, wouldn't care.
The training is first rate, Carolina said.
Maybe, I said. I was ready for a new adventure. Warsaw would be a fresh start, and I was good at this. I moved on to the next patient and began with the face. I was making good time. Soon, I would be done with the whole row. I ran the washcloth across the bridge of the nose to uncover fresh pink skin, and I froze. Midwife.
What is it, Kasia? Carolina asked.
My mind registered it all, but my body was stuck. I breathed deeply through my nose and grabbed the stretcher handle for support. It would not look good to have a nurse in training faint right there in the ward.
Chapter 32, Kasia, 1945.
It couldn't possibly be him. Pietrik. How many times had my mind played such tricks? The tooth. I pulled his upper lip up with my thumb.
What are you doing, Kasia?
Carolina set her basin on the floor and walked over to me.
My God.
Yes. The chipped tooth. Just a little off the side. That gorgeous tooth. I sat for a few moments waiting for my body to catch up with my brain. Yes, it was he. I kissed him all over his face, dirt and everything. He stayed unconscious through it all.
Kasia, Carolina said, eyes wide.
I called to the other nurses, waving. I must have looked like a castaway on a desert island, unable to get the words out. The nurses ran over, and Carolina told them I was having a mental breakdown of some sort, kissing and crying over a Russian soldier. It's him! It's him! Was all I could say.
Who, Kasia? Carolina asked. Who is it? Calm down, now.
It's Pietrik, I said.
You're Pietrik? Are you sure?
I could only nod yes, and the girls hugged and kissed me. They helped me change Pietrik out of his dirty uniform and finish his bed bath. He remained unconscious, and I sat with him holding his hand, reveling in my good fortune. I asked the nurses to go and get Susanna while I stayed with Pietrik, afraid he would disappear. Through a translator, we learned the Russian man in the next cot had fought alongside Pietrik. Once the Russians liberated Majdanek concentration camp, the Red Army had pressed Pietrik into service. He said Pietrik had been at Majdanek since he'd been arrested and had worked with the rest of the slave laborers there to finish building the camp. Susanna and Papa helped me move Pietrik home to my bedroom that evening. He had lost much of his body fat, but Susanna examined him and said it was possible he would recover. She had seen a lot of head trauma. Many times, once the swelling subsided, the patient regained normal brain function. It was weeks before Pietrik opened his eyes, and even longer before he spoke. But I was grateful for every small step.
I carried a matchbox in which to place a piece of sausage or a bit of ham for him whenever I had a chance. And in time, he grew stronger. Susanna and I celebrated his first words.
"Turn up the radio, please."
With our own private party, while Pietrik watched from his bed with a trace of a smile on his lips. He was like a bird I'd seen once, knocked unconscious after flying headfirst into our kitchen window. He came to be himself slowly. And then suddenly one day, he was up and walking again. We didn't press for details of his years at Majdanek, and he didn't volunteer them. We each carried our own bag of troubles. Once he could walk, Pietrik made up for lost time and was hired to be the caretaker for the glassworks factory, which the owner reopened. As his body filled out, he also took a job driving ambulances for the Lublin Ambulance Corps. But for all his physical improvements, it was as if Pietrik had a piece missing. The kissing piece, mostly. He sank all effort into his work, avoiding any chance of romance with me. I devised excuses for this. He was too tired, too sad, too happy. One morning I woke to the rumble of thunder, thinking I was back at Ravensbrück, the bombs thudding in the distance. I relaxed once I saw the drops on my bedroom window, though. Once I remembered I was to ride alongside Pietrik in the ambulance that day. As a nurse in training, I got to sit up front with the driver. Since he avoided being alone with me then, barely even touched me, it was nice to be so close to him all morning with nothing but the stick shift between us. The rain would keep him in the ambulance cab, windows up, all to myself. I arranged myself there in the front seat of the ambulance, feeling smart in my white nurse in training uniform and cap. Maybe he would kiss me. Could I kiss him first? That was terribly forward, of course, but what did I know about such things? I'd been locked away for some of my teen years, the time you'll learn the rituals of romance. Did Pietrik even still find me attractive? The white stockings we all wore did little to camouflage my bad leg. Every so often people would stop and stare, open-mouthed, what happened to you look on their faces. Did he find me grotesque? What if I told him what Luisa had said, that he loved me? But I could never betray her dying wish. "Such traffic," he said, downshifting. "Where is everyone getting gas in this town? We'll take the long way to the hospital." Since he'd come home, Pietrik got impatient and angry at the smallest thing, snarled traffic, a mispronounced word, a sprinkle of rain. "There's no rush," I said, "just delivering stretchers." The rain was coming down harder now, the windshield wipers fighting a losing battle. A gully washer, Matka would have called it. Matka. We turned down Nadia Street. "We are going to drive by her house," I said. "I know, Kasia. I can see." "You never told me what Zagota meant, on the envelope I picked up." "The Council to Aid Jews. Nadia's mother knew one of the founders." "Where did you hide them?" "I'd rather not. You can't avoid talking about it forever." He downshifted and busied himself with driving, his gaze directed at the road. "They lived in different safe apartments," he said eventually, "until they weren't safe anymore. Z's basement for a time. Once we were arrested..." Traffic slowed as we drove closer to Nadia's old apartment, the orange door shiny with rain. I saw it first, the black heap of wet fur on the doorstep. "Stop, Pietrik. It's Felka."
"Again?" Pietrik said.
He pulled the emergency brake, turned on the flashing lights atop the vehicle, and jumped out. I scrambled out, too, as best I could from the high ambulance cab, and got to the top of the stairs. There was Felka curled on the doormat, drenched with rain, but looking only a bit sheepish. The new residents were the Riskas, a nice teacher and his wife, who had been bombed out in Warsaw. Mrs. Riska was a cousin of Mrs. Bekovsky's, and they'd move to Lublin, lured by the new government's offer of free housing. The government had to make this offer since many Polish people were wary of the new government and stayed away, worried that Poland might not end up as free and independent as Stalin claimed. Even with free houses offered, so many still stayed in London or other places, waiting to see. The Ryskas were understanding about Felka showing up on their stoop so often and called us whenever they found her there. Papa tried everything to keep her home, locked her in the house, tied her up, but she still managed to escape. We all knew who she was waiting for. Cars started lining up, blocked behind the ambulance as we tried to lure her back to the dry cab. "Come, girl," said Pietrik, sweet as could be, but Felka wouldn't budge. "You take her front, I'll take the rear," he said. We carried Felka back to the street. Once the drivers in the car saw the ambulance was stopped for a canine and not a human needing care, the horn started honking. We managed to get her into the cab of the ambulance and lay her between us, and I wrapped a terry cloth towel around her. As Pietrik pulled away from the house, Felka shivered and shook, sending water flying about the cab and onto our faces. I brushed a smear of dirt off the front of my uniform. So much for the kiss. "Nadia could still be out there somewhere," I said. "Drive behind Felka's ears. She likes that." I brushed the towel over the dog's head and under her grizzled muzzle. "DPs are still coming home."
"Don't call her a displaced person, Kasia. Tell the truth. She was murdered by the Nazis and is gone, just like the rest."
"At least your mother gets a memorial service tomorrow."
"It's not just hers, Kasia. It's for 200 people and is going to be a circus. Please don't go."
"Papa said there will be NKVD agents there."
"What will they do to me? Kill me? As long as it's quick, I'll welcome it."
"They are looking for AK members, any high-ranking member of the underground."
"I was a Red Army soldier, Kasia."
"Against your will."
"So that gets me a pass for now."
"Papa said..."
"Enough, Papa said, Kasia. Don't you think for yourself anymore?"
I rubbed Felka's belly with a towel, and she turned over onto her back, legs in the air. "Maybe I shouldn't have done your couriering for you," I said.
"Don't you think I live with that every day? Not only my sister, who was barely out of braces, but your mother, who was dear to me too, Kasia. Dead. And what they did to you? And here I am, healthy and fine. What kind of a man am I? Sometimes I think, if I didn't have you..."
He turned and looked at me.
"I wouldn't want to be here."
I searched his face. Had he really said that? He fixed his gaze back on the road, but I'd heard it. "If I didn't have you..." I reached for his hand, resting on the seat. "Don't say that, Pietrik. It's a mortal sin and..." He pulled his hand away.
"Never mind," he said, two hands back on the wheel. He drove on, lost in thought. "Forget I said it."
It was good to see a bit of Pietrik's old self. But, like the sun coming out on a cloudy day, it disappeared just as fast as it had emerged. I didn't honor Pietrik's request not to go to the memorial service at Lublin Castle. It was held to honor the lives of the forced laborers murdered there by the Nazis before they withdrew, including Pietrik's mother. I had loved Mrs. Bukowski and needed to mourn with the others. All of Lublin would be there. And besides, I knew many of the families with mothers, sisters, and husbands who died that day. Everyone knew someone impacted by that mass murder. I started the day in the castle chapel, once Matka's favorite place, kneeling high above the gathering crowds below. The chapel had become my special place to steal away to as well, to pray and talk with my mother and stay warm. The beautiful Byzantine frescoes had not yet been completely uncovered then, but I could see bits of them along the high ceilings between the Gothic arches. I prayed for my usual list. Papa, Susanna, Pietrik, for the souls of the dead and missing. Nadia, Matka. From the chapel window, I considered the gathering crowd below, scattered down the grassy slope outside the great wall of the castle. People had come from all over Poland to pay respects. The church choir sang as people, old and young, clustered there in groups, jockeying for the choicest front spots with the best views of the service. Collections of black-frocked priests, a gaggle of Dominican nuns, their white headpieces like giant swans, Lublin families. Papa and Marta in there somewhere. Susanna would be listening to it all from an open window at the hospital. I descended the spiral staircase slowly, for my bad leg and slippery stone stairs were a scary combination, and emerged out in the stone courtyard where we'd all once been rounded up to be transported to Ravensbrück. Had I been standing there with Matka, Luisa, and Susanna just 5 years before? I made my way down the grassy slope and pushed through the crowd. Though it had been a warm fall, it was cold that day. People in the crowd carried bouquets, mostly globe flowers, scarlet corn poppies, and other wild flowers. I held some fall daisies I'd found growing in an empty lot. I'd wrapped them in a wet dish rag, and the cold water burned my hand, even through the glove I wore. I blew on my free hand as I scanned the crowd for Pietrik. What I wouldn't give for two gloves. I had split a pair with Susanna after a dying woman had gifted it to her at the hospital. I had the right one, Susanna the left. It was hard to imagine more than 300 people buried there under that slope in the shadow of the great fortress. Family members stood along the base of the castle grounds where townspeople had hastily buried the murdered in that mass grave. Someone had pounded a great wooden cross into the heart of the hill, and six priests stood below it. The priests blessed the gravesite, and I made my way through the crowd looking for Pietrik. Would he be angry I came? Should I just give up on him? A girl could only take so much rejection. I approached a group of nuns clustered at one end, prayer candles and cards in their hands, a few of them with wreaths draped over their arms. I spotted Pietrik off to the side of them. He stood alone, back straight, hands deep in his glassworks canvas coat pockets, eyes on the service. He was near the edge of a great pile of flowers that mourners had assembled there, a growing mound of reds and pinks and yellows. I inched down the slope to him, pain stabbing my leg with each step. I shimmied through the group of nuns, lingering briefly in their warmth, swishing through the sea of black habits, rosary beads long at their waists. I emerged and walked toward Pietrik. If he saw me approach, he gave no sign of it. As I drew closer, I saw his face was splotched red about the eyes. I made my way to him and stood nearby. I fisted my naked hand and blew hot breath on it. Pietrik turned to look at me, his eyelashes spiky with tears. I stepped to the mound of flowers and set my daisies atop it, then turned and walked back to him. Should I stay? I'd left my flowers, had done what I'd come to do, paid my respects. He'd asked me not to come after all. Receiving no gesture from Pietrik, I turned to go, and just then felt his hand on my arm. I almost could not believe it as I watched his fingers make their way around my wrist. He pulled me to him to stand by his side. Proud is a word that is too commonly used, but that is how I felt there that day, listening to the choir sing to heaven. such pride that Pietrik wanted me to share it all with him, the good and the bad. He reached for my bare hand and held it, his warm fingers around mine, brought it to his lips to kiss, and tucked it in his pocket, the flannel warm inside. Chapter 33, Kasha, 1946. The army arrived from all directions. Not since Hitler's Blitzkrieg had there been such an organized onslaught. In flowered dresses and sensible shoes, they came hauling pots and dishes, some still steaming, fresh from the oven. General Marta coordinated the effort at the postal center, resulting in enough pierogies and beet soup and hunter's stew to feed 6 wedding parties. You think a postal center an odd place for a wedding party? Maybe, but it served well for our purposes. It is a big open space with a high ceiling, and you can kill 2 pheasants with 1 stone there, pick up your mail, and dance with the bride. Not that the bride could dance, but guests pinned money to my dress anyway. I wore a pale pink dress, not my choice, for Martha had surprised me with a product of her own sewing machine. I'd wanted white, but it was impossible to turn down this dress, for I was trying to be civil for Papa. I just wanted it all to be over so I could be alone with Pietrik. It had been a difficult morning for 2 reasons. One was that the Rizkas had phoned to say Felka had died the day before. They'd found her on the front stoop one last time. We buried Felka in our back garden. Susanna and Papa came by and watched as Pietrik dug his spade into the earth, and I wrapped Felka in Nadia's blanket I'd brought her home in so many years ago. We all cried, saying goodbye to our old girl, Papa harder than any of us. I couldn't help think that Felka had been a loyal friend to Nadia, waiting for her till the end, unlike me, who'd moved on with my life, planning my wedding with barely a thought that Nadia would not be there. Some friend I was. The other difficult thing on my wedding morning was the blessing by the mother of the bride. So important is this blessing at a Polish wedding that if the bride's mother is deceased, the wedding party walks to the cemetery to visit her grave before going to the church. Of course, we could not visit the lake at Ravensbrück, where Matka's ashes had probably gone. Martha had prepared a long blessing, but I chose Susanna to give the blessing instead, causing the heat to rise in Martha's face. Resigned as I was to making amends with Martha, it was not always easy. Susanna came first in my life, and always would. The ceremony at the church was brief. Though free elections had still not taken place, and the Stalinist authorities were not in official control, Moscow's Polish Workers' Party was becoming more entrenched by the day. They discouraged anything that distracted workers from the collective needs of the people, including church weddings. They considered them gaudy spectacles, so people were wary of being seen at them. As a result, only 3 of my nurse friends braved the ceremony, though it could have cost them their jobs. The few friends Pietrik had left from the underground were still hiding out in the forest. We all were careful, since just putting flowers on a former AK member's grave was cause for arrest. Guests were not shy about celebrating at the postal center, though, for it was somewhat private there. As soon as I arrived, guests surrounded me and pinned paper money to my dress, my favorite tradition of all. Where had Martha and her friends gotten such food? Cold cuts, sausages, salads, tree cake and delicate pastry angel wings. Maybe the food came from Nalevo, the black market. "Come, it's time for Ochepini," Martha said. Ochepini is the ritual of taking off the bride's veil and replacing it with a cap to show she is officially married. First the single women surround the bride and take her veil, then the married ones circle the bride and pin the cap. Martha clapped her hands above her head, and the single girls came around. "Susanna, remove the veil." She knows what to do, Marta, I said. The band played, and the young girl circled me, hands together, as my sister took the hairpins from Pietrik's mother's veil. My bad leg ached from standing so long, but how could I go sit with the old ladies on their folding chairs lined up against the wall? I dreamed of this wedding ritual since childhood. Susanna handed the veil to me and joined the circle. I covered my eyes with one hand and tossed the veil with my other, timing it perfectly for it to land in Susanna's hands. God willing, she would be next. "Now, married ladies, assemble," Marta called to the crowd. She held the white cap in her hand. Where was Pietrik? He was missing it all. "Who will pin the cap?" I asked. "I will," Marta said. "But the married woman must do that." The married woman gathered about me in a circle, hands together. Marta stepped closer. "Kasia, that's just an old folk tradition." The married women began circling around Marta and me to the music. The smell of violet perfume and beet soup was overpowering. I grabbed a hand at random and pulled the tanner's wife into the middle of the circle. "Mrs. Wisnowski will pin my cap." Marta took my hand. "Kasia, please let me do this." One look at her brown eyes tearing up was all I needed. She had been good to me after all. Had fed Pietrik, Susanna, and me back to health. I let Marta pin my cap, and she burst out in a smile. "You've never seen a happier person in your life." I broke out of the circle, the paper bills flapping as I walked. Where was Pietrik? He'd been so quiet all day. I stopped on my way to find him, to let a friend of Papa's pin another zloty note to my dress. I found Pietrik in Papa's office, alone, slumped in the old leather desk chair, hands in his lap. The lamps were off, and a glint of light from a street lamp hit the glass on a picture on the desk. It was Papa's favorite, though my eyes were half closed in it. The one with his arms around Susanna and me, taken by my mother. "Come and join the party." I brushed the millet from Pietrik's hair, still there from when guests had thrown it as we left the church. The millet Papa had buried that night so long ago. Dangerous as it was to call attention to the ceremony, I was happy some had not been able to let the tradition of throwing millet go. I knelt beside Pietrik. "You haven't eaten a thing. The hunter stew's almost gone, and they just brought more of those sausages you like. Plus, they're going to dance the kujawiak." "Soon, Kasia." Pietrik was a quiet person, but he had never been given to such brooding. "They are wondering where the groom is," I said. He was quiet for a long minute, his face in shadows. What a coward I am, Kasia. My old underground reports hiding in the woods, eating grass, while I'm here feasting. The music in the other room reached a fever pitch. "It's not your fault Papa wants to protect his son-in-law. We have our troubles too, you know." "I am just thinking about what my father would do if he were here. He was no coward." Though Pietrik seldom spoke of it, more rumors had surfaced about Katyn Forest, and though the Russians blamed the Nazis, we all knew it was the Russian NKVD who'd murdered thousands of Polish intelligentsia there. Captain Bukowski had most likely been among those executed. "What are you talking about?" I put my head in his lap and felt something cold and hard in his hand. As he pulled it away, I saw a glint of light on silver. "Papa's gun?" I said. "Are you..."
"It makes me feel better to hold it," Pietrik said.
I eased the gun from his hand.
"You'd better get back," Pietrik said. "The bride can't just disappear."
Simply touching that gun, smooth and heavy, made my whole body cold. "They want to see you as well," I said. He made no effort to grab the gun back. I opened Papa's desk drawer and placed it inside. "Oh, Pietrik," I said, kneeling next to him.
We stayed there in the dark together for some time and listened to the guests sing as the band played Stolat. 100 years of happiness for the bride and groom.
Chapter 34. Hatta, 1947. The so-called doctor's trial at Nuremberg was a farce from beginning to end, and the trauma of it caused me a series of debilitating bronchial infections. The waiting, the reams of paper that could have been burned to keep good Germans from freezing, the 139 trial days, 85 witnesses, and endless defendant cross-examinations. Dr. Gebhardt's testimony alone was 3 days long and especially difficult to watch. As he explained the operations in great detail, he only dragged Fritz and me down with him. Gebhardt even offered to have the same operation performed on himself to prove how harmless the procedures were, but his offer was ignored. And why did I ask my lawyer, Dr. Alfred Seidel, to tell me the fates of Binz and Marshall from the trial of Ravensbrück camp staff, the so-called Ravensbrück trial at Hamburg, on the day I was to testify? It only roused more fear about going on the stand that morning. "They took Elisabeth Marshall first," Alfred said, "then Dorothea Binz, and Wilma Hartmann last. Ladies first, I suppose." My abdominal muscles contracted as he indicated the picture in the newspaper. It showed Wilma, hands fastened behind his back, neck broken at the fifth vertebra, his feet hanging there in their beautiful shoes. He had dropped well. The noose knot, placed under his left jaw, had broken the axis bone, which in turn severed the spinal cord. I scanned the pictures of the others, all hung like ducks on a hunter's rack, and was convulsed with a terrible fear, which sent tremors to my hands. Many of them had turned to religion before they walked up the 13 steps to the gallows. All were buried in nameless graves. That day's events in court did nothing to calm me either. First up, a rabbit from Ravensbrück on the witness stand. "Can you identify Dr. Hertha Oberhäuser?" Alexander Hardy, associate counsel for the prosecution, asked. He was a reasonably attractive man with a receding hairline. The rabbit pointed to me. How could that be? They remembered me? I had no memory of them. They knew my name? We'd been so careful. Alfred had told me the Poles asked to have me extradited to Poland to stand trial. Only me. Had others not done much worse? Alfred had challenged this request and won. Soon, it was my turn. "We call Hertha Oberhäuser to the stand," Hardy said. Fritz gave me a look designed to instill courage. I took a deep breath, the blood pounding in my head. I made my way to the stand, the crowd a blur, and scanned the balcony for Mutti. "How could you participate in the sulfonamide experiments in good conscience, Hertha Oberhäuser?" Hardy asked. "Those prisoners were Polish women who were sentenced to death," I said. "They were scheduled to die anyway. That research helped German soldiers. My blood." I found Mutti in the balcony, fingers raised to her lips. "No, Günther?" Hardy waved a sheaf of papers in my direction. "Were any persons shot or executed after they had been subjected to these experiments?" "Yes, but they were political prisoners with..." The red light bulb attached to the witness stand in front of me lit up. The interpreters were having trouble keeping up. I would have to slow down. "Political prisoners with death sentences." And in your affidavit in connection with lethal injections, you admit that you gave 5 or 6 lethal injections. Is that correct?
Why had I admitted that in my affidavit? Could I?